International law, it often seems so, well, abstract, doesn't it? Something that's happening way out there, on the global stage. But not today.
No, not today.
Because today we're looking at a case where international law, well, it crashes right into the U.S. legal system, and the results are very, very real.
What's so fascinating about Yusuf V. Samantar is it really wrestles with this idea of accountability. Can a former government official be held responsible for, human rights abuses that happen while they're in power, even after they've left office?
And it gets even more personal, more intense in this case, doesn't it? We're talking about torture victims, Somali torture victims, specifically members of the Isaac clan who went through just awful things under the Bar regime back in the 80s. And they brought this lawsuit against Mohamed Samantar, who was a high-ranking Somali official. He was living here in the U.S. as a permanent resident.
Absolutely. It's a powerful example of how these global events can like slam right into our domestic legal system. And this case in particular, it brings up some pretty thorny issues around immunity.
Okay, so let's step back for a second. Can you give us like a quick snapshot of the background? Who are the major players here?
Sure. So the story starts with this really brutal dictatorship, Siad Barre in Somalia. It lasted for over 2 decades. And during that time, the regime, well, they committed systematic human rights abuses. And the Isaac clan, they were specifically targeted, facing torture, extrajudicial killings, the whole terrible nine yards. And then years later, some of these victims, they find themselves face to face with the guy they say is responsible for their suffering, Mohamed Samantar. And where do they find him? Here in the United States.
It's wow, that's a chilling thought. So Mintar, he had some pretty high up positions in the Barre regime, right?
Yeah, he served as both the Minister of Defense and the Prime Minister. So the people who brought the lawsuit, they argued that he was directly responsible for the horrible things that happened to them.
And his defense, was it all about immunity?
That's right. Samantar said he couldn't be sued in U.S. courts because he was entitled to immunity for things he did as a government official.
Okay, so this takes us right to the core of the case. Immunity. But it's not as simple as like, oh, he was a government official, so we're done here, is it?
No, it's definitely not that simple. There are different types of immunity in international law, and this case really digs into all the little details, all those distinctions.
Could you break down those different types of immunity for us? What are we really dealing with in this case?
Of course. So the first one is status-based immunity, which gives like complete protection to current heads of state. But that didn't apply in Samantar's case because he wasn't in office anymore.
So then we're left with the second type, which is.
Conduct-based immunity. This type of immunity protects official acts, things people did on behalf of a state, even if those people aren't, in office anymore.
So what Samantar was saying is, even if these things were awful, he was just doing his job. He was representing the Somali government, and so he should be protected.
Exactly. But here's the big question the court had to deal with. Can any act, no matter how horrible, be considered an official act that deserves immunity? And that's where it gets really, really interesting.
Because, at first glance, it's hard to imagine how something like torture could ever be seen as a legitimate government function.
You've hit the nail on the head. And this is where we get to this concept of just Cogens norms. These are basically the fundamental principles of international law, those big universal no-nos that no state can say they're above. Stuff like torture, genocide, slavery, all of that falls right into this category.
So let me get this straight. Even if a government says, hey, torture is part of our official policy, those actions are never protected by immunity because they're violating these core principles, these just Cogens norms.
Exactly. The court in Yusuf V. Samantar, they were very clear. Just Cogens violations can never be legitimate state actions. So immunity doesn't apply.
That makes sense. But it seems like this case wasn't just about these like big legal ideas. There were also specific details the court looked at.
Right. Oh, absolutely. For instance, the U.S. State Department, they actually got involved and said they didn't think Samantar should get immunity.
Now, that's interesting. Why would the State Department do that?
Well, one reason is there wasn't even a real Somali government at the time to request immunity for him. And the State Department also said that because Samantar was living in the U.S., there wasn't as much risk of damaging foreign relations, which, that's usually a huge deal in these immunity cases.
Wait, hold on. Can you explain that a little more? What do you mean by foreign relations concerns?
Well, you see, immunity is partly about diplomacy. If the U.S. just started prosecuting former officials from other countries without their permission, well, it could cause all sorts of trouble, It could really mess up relationships, maybe even escalate into some kind of international incident. So those concerns, they're always on the table in these kinds of cases.
I see, I see. So the State Department was basically saying that because Samantar was already here in the U.S., those foreign relations concerns weren't as big of a deal.
Exactly. But it's also important to remember that the court didn't just, like, rubber stamp the State Department's opinion. They did their own homework, looked at the legal issues, and came to their own conclusion. And they really emphasized that Just Cogens trumps immunity concerns.
So they weren't just letting politics decide things. They actually dove into the law.
Yeah, they did. And there's another crucial point the court made. They said former officials like Samantar, they can be held accountable. But current heads of state, they still get total immunity, even for Just Cogens violations.
Mm. Well, at first, that seems kind of unfair, doesn't it? Why would current leaders get a free pass for something as serious as, you know, torture?
It definitely raises some questions, and it really shows that tension between, you know, upholding international justice and respecting state sovereignty. It's messy, that's for sure. But that distinction, it exists for a reason.
Okay, so help me out here. The court's basically saying that even if a state does some terrible things, those actions aren't legitimate if they're violating these fundamental Just Cogens norms.
Precisely. And in Samantar's case, the things he was accused of doing, they were so horrific that they couldn't be hidden behind this idea of conduct-based immunity.
This has been so insightful. It's really amazing how one case can bring up so many big questions. Let's take a second to think about what we've learned so far before we move on to the impact of Yusuf v. Samantar.
I think it's important, you know, to step back and acknowledge the weight of this case. Yusuf v. Samantar, it's not just, you know, a win for the people involved in the lawsuit.
It feels much bigger, right? Like a real turning point. So does this mean we could see a bunch of new human rights lawsuits, you know, against former officials who are living here in the U.S.?
It's definitely possible. This case opens the door for victims to, you know, seek justice in U.S. courts, even if those terrible things happen somewhere else.
That's huge.
It's a strong message that people who commit atrocities, they can't just run away and escape being held accountable.
I bet this gives hope to a lot of people who felt like they had no options before.
Absolutely. It's like a beacon for those seeking justice. And it could be a model for future cases, you know, both here and around the world.
It also shows that the U.S. has a role to play in upholding these international legal standards, right?
Right.
The court was willing to hold a former foreign official accountable. That says a lot about our commitment to justice.
Exactly. It reinforces this idea that some actions are so wrong, so fundamentally wrong, that they go beyond national borders. They demand a response from everyone.
This case, it really gets you thinking about other areas of international law. Could this Trojans exception be used in other types of cases?
That's a great question. It's something legal scholars will be debating for years to come. This case could influence litigation related to war crimes, crimes against humanity, even things like environmental UNCTAD.
Wow, it seems like we're only beginning to understand the full impact of Yusuf v. Samantar.
We are, and that's what makes it so fascinating. This isn't just about, you know, a legal win for these specific people. It's a landmark decision that could change how we think about accountability and justice globally.
It's incredible how much one case can affect things, how interconnected we all are. Even across borders.
Exactly. It emphasizes how important international law is in providing a framework for tackling these really complex issues.
I can already see law students studying this case for years and years.
Oh, it's going to be a classic in international law courses. It touches on so many fundamental ideas. It's a gold mine.
It really gets you thinking, though.
Yeah.
If former officials can be held accountable for violating Just Cogens norms, what about current officials, you know, after they leave office?
You're getting right to the heart of it. Does the logic of Yusuf v. Samantar suggest that even current officials could be held accountable one day for things they did while they were in power?
That's a really thought-provoking question. It seems like the next logical step based on this case.
It does. And it's a question that I'm sure will be debated in legal circles. It gets to the very core of accountability for those in positions of power.
It also raises questions about how effective international institutions are in addressing these issues.
Absolutely. The International Criminal Court, for example, they've had their own struggles in holding powerful people accountable.
This case also shows how much more aware people are of human rights issues around the world. It seems like people aren't willing to ignore atrocities anymore, no matter where they happen.
I agree. There's a growing feeling of responsibility, a shared responsibility to protect human rights and hold the perpetrators accountable.
So where does this leave us? What are the key takeaways for our listeners? Especially those in the legal field.
I think the biggest takeaway is that immunity isn't a foolproof shield. When it comes to the most serious violations of international law, the courts are more willing to find ways to hold individuals responsible.
It reminds us that even in a world where power often seems unchecked, there are still ways to achieve justice.
Exactly. It's a testament to how resilient people are, our constant drive for a fairer world.
This has been such an insightful conversation. It's amazing how one case can spark so many important discussions. But before we finish, I have one last thought for our listeners. So we've been discussing how former officials can be held accountable for just Kojin's violations. But what about individuals currently in government positions? Could they be held liable, you know, under the same logic, once they're out of office, of course?
That's the question, isn't it? The one that really makes you think. The impact of Yusuf v. Samantar, it could go way beyond this one case. It raises some really big questions about, you know, power, about accountability, even about how we define justice on a global scale.
It's a lot to wrap your head around. We're talking about holding powerful people accountable for things they did while representing their countries. It feels like, I don't know, like we're in uncharted territory here.
We are, in a way, and right. It makes us confront this difficult balance. How do we make sure victims get justice, but also respect the sovereignty of nations? It's tough. There's no easy answer.
But they're important questions, questions we can't ignore. This case, it's like opening a Pandora's box. It makes us rethink how individuals and states relate to each other under international law.
Absolutely. It shows how dynamic international law really is. Yusuf v. Samantar, it's a clear sign that things are changing. These old ideas about immunity, they're being examined a lot more closely now.
So for our listeners who want to learn more, to really dig into these issues, what would you suggest? Where should they start?
Well, staying informed is crucial. Follow what's happening in international human rights law, read about cases like this one, and, you know, participate in discussions about these complex topics.
It's true what they say. Knowledge is power. The more we understand, the better we can advocate for a more just world.
I couldn't agree more. And remember, Yusuf v. Samantar isn't just some random event. It's part of this larger movement towards greater accountability. This recognition that even powerful people, they're not above the law. It shows that change is possible and we all have a part to play in making a more just future.
That's a great point to end on. Yusuf v. Samantar is a case that will have a lasting impact. It shows how the law can hold even the most powerful individuals accountable and how justice can prevail, even across borders.
Absolutely. It's a call to action for all of us to engage in these vital conversations, to work together to create a world where human rights are truly respected and protected.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into Yusuf v. Samantar. We hope you found it as thought-provoking as we did. Until next time, keep learning. Keep asking those tough questions and keep fighting for a more just world.